The next area that we want to go into is a whole new area. I've mentioned to you before that we would talk about ethics for a certain time, and we talked about doctor-patient relationships, doctor-doctor relationships, and then doctor-public relationships. So we have concluded that section of the lectures, and what we want to do now is go into the area of jurisprudence. And in terms of chiropractic jurisprudence, what we're basically talking about here is the area of malpractice. That's the area of jurisprudence that comes up mostly. And so we need to understand malpractice and understand what malpractice is and how it fits into a chiropractor's practice, and some steps that we can take to avoid being accused of malpractice. You know, we might think of malpractice as sort of a new occurrence in the legal world. We know that since 1975, there has been a significant increase in malpractice cases, both in medicine and in chiropractic. It certainly is not new. If we look back in history, we'll find out that in America, the first reported malpractice action was in 1794, so quite a while back. We have seen in the past 25 years sort of a pretty good percentage of increase in the occurrence of cases, and we're becoming more and more aware of chiropractic malpractice. It seems that we are dealing now with a public that is more litigious and more willing to sue, and looking for reasons to sue, and we have to deal with that as a fact, and we have to know sort of how to deal with it. Under basic law, it's important that you understand the legal structure enough to understand where malpractice fits in. The two branches of law that most Americans are fairly familiar with, and there are other branches, by the way, but the two branches that we're most familiar with are civil law and criminal law. It's pretty easy to tell the difference. One of the ways you can tell the difference is when the bailiff reads the name of the case. The name of the case, if one of the parties in the case is a governmental agency, then we probably have a criminal case, more likely than not. If both names in the case name are people's names, then we probably have a civil action. Now, criminal action means that some person has broken a rule, a statute, or a law made by somebody. Now, that law may be a federal law made by federal congressional officials signed by the president. It may be a state law made by a state legislature signed by a governor. It may be a city law having to do with a noise ordinance or speeding going 35 in a 25-mile zone. You know, these are traffic court kinds of items, but those are municipal laws. So we can have levels, the real local level criminal actions like traffic court. We can have a little bigger ones, state law cases, and we can have real big ones, federal law cases, and of course it's possible to go on up to international law. But for most of us, we're dealing with criminal actions and or civil actions. Civil actions are not one government agency filing action against a particular citizen. This is one citizen against another citizen. That's civil action. Kramer versus Kramer is a civil case. It involves two citizens in a dispute, and in their dispute, one party decides to take legal action, file a lawsuit. And we start going through the process, and we're going through the civil system. In criminal court, you may be arrested by a policeman, someone may file charges against you, but you have broken a state law, a federal law, or a municipal law, and you're going to be tried in a criminal court, and you have criminal possibilities facing you. In a criminal action, several things can happen to you if you're found guilty of a criminal action. Number one is we can take your money, we can take your wealth. And we do that by the system of fines. You know, for certain actions that are not too severe, you'll be fined $500, $1,000. You know, you can be fined hundreds of thousands of dollars sometimes. So they take your money, that's one thing. If it's a little more severe, then we're going to take your liberty from you. We're going to put you in jail. So that's what happens in criminal acts. You go to jail for 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 20 years, or life. Okay, so that's part of a criminal action. In very severe cases, certain very specified and severe cases, not only could we take your money, take your liberty, we can take your life in a criminal action. We have certain crimes that are punishable by death. And, you know, most noticeably it's murder, first degree murder, sometimes attempting to kill the president, and kidnapping and involving murder, and you know, certain aggravated actions, then we can take your life. So we have the execution available as a penalty. Most frequently, however, people are put in jail or they're fined. You know, those are the punishments that you face in a criminal action. When you're in a civil action, you have one person suing another person. Most always, what the person doing the suing, what they're looking for is money. Most of the time, they're suing for damages. They're saying, I have been hurt, I've been injured, I've been damaged, and I want payment for it. You're going to have to pay. And so a civil action is most frequently suing for money damages in a particular case. Malpractice falls into civil damages, of course. There is one brief exception, or one minor exception, that is called criminal malpractice. You know, and this is when somebody is just so egregiously criminal in their malpractice that they did something intentional. This is intentional, willful malpractice, as if you know, a surgeon kind of went crazy and carved his initials in somebody's abdomen. And that happened recently. Remember Dr. Zorro? You know, that's criminal malpractice. When you're just, you know, off on a tangent that involves willful malpractice, okay, then it's criminal malpractice. In the old days of before Roe v. Wade, before abortion was given approval in the federal court system, performing an abortion was considered criminal malpractice prior to Roe v. Wade. And doctors were accused of murder when they did abortions, not an abortion. So Roe v. Wade legitimized abortion. In civil cases, when a patient sues a doctor for malpractice, as I said, this is a civil action. This is a civil action under a particular branch of civil law. It's called tort law, T-O-R-T. A tort in Latin is something crooked. You've heard of torticollis, you know, a crooked neck, it's a stiff neck. Tort of pelvis, when the pelvis is distorted because of muscle spasm or something. But a tort is a crooked act or a wrongful action for which damages can be gotten. It's not a contract breach, okay? That's another branch of civil law, is contract law. And some people over the years have seen the doctor-patient relationship really as a contract. And that if you did something in the malpractice realm, you're breaking a contract. And so some people have seen this as a potential way to deal with it. Doctor does some malpractice thing, he breached a contract, he broke the contract. And we can sue you for breach of contract. That's not how it's handled, by the way. The way it's handled is it's handled under tort law. A person commits a tort, a wrongful act for which damages can be gotten. They can be sued for malpractice if this is in this particular realm. Another name used for malpractice is professional negligence. A professional person who has a duty to uphold a certain standard of care in dealing with a patient somehow breaches that duty, doesn't fulfill that duty, that is called negligent conduct. All right? And a person who is negligent in his or her conduct toward a patient, and by that negligence causes injury, all right? And the injury and the negligence are causally connected. Okay? There's a connection between the injury and the negligence. Then we're looking at malpractice. Malpractice has to, in order for there to be malpractice, you have to be able to run this formula. The formula says this, that first of all, you have to have a duty toward the patient. I must owe that patient the duty of good service. So what we're saying is here is that this person must be my patient. I must engage in a doctor-patient relationship before there can be malpractice. So once I have engaged in a doctor-patient relationship, the patient has hired me to be their doctor, and I have agreed without duress, without any threat or without anything else, I have agreed to become this patient's doctor. They've agreed to be my patient. We now have a doctor-patient relationship. I now owe that patient a duty of good performance. I owe that patient my best service. I owe that patient all my knowledge, all my skill, and that it will be performed in a satisfactory way, in a standard way, a way that is most frequently done by reasonable doctors of similar skills and credentialing. So, first thing is that they must really be my patient. So once I have accepted a patient and they've accepted me as a doctor, we have entered into a relationship, we now owe each other something. I owe most because I'm on the professional side. So as the doctor, I owe this patient my best service at this point. I owe them performance of the proper standard of care. I am obligated to perform the proper standard of care. So I have to have a duty to them. That's the first thing. If then I am negligent, second part of the formula, if I am negligent in my performance of that standard of care, okay, then we have negligence. How do we decide what the standard of care is? In malpractice actions, one of the things, if you've been involved in a malpractice case or ever seen one or heard of one, we have expert witnesses. We have an expert witness from both sides, the side doing the suing and the side being defended here. We'll have an expert witness. And an expert witness, having heard the case and heard all the details, makes a determination and renders an opinion as to whether the doctor in this case upheld the standard of care, meaning the doctor did what the doctor should have done. That will determine whether or not there's been negligence. If the expert witness says this doctor did exactly what a doctor should have done, he did the right thing. He made the proper diagnosis. He did the proper workup. He did the proper care, and he did everything that an average and reasonable doctor should have done, then the opinion of that expert witness would be that there was no negligence. There is no negligence. If there is no negligence, there is no malpractice. It has to be there in the formula for there to be malpractice. Now, the other expert witness on the other side is going to have a different opinion, obviously. And that expert witness would be of the opinion and make the statement in court that this doctor fell below the standard of care in the following areas. 1, 2, 3, 4. He should have done this, he didn't do this. Should have done this, he didn't do this. Therefore, he fell below the standard of care. Falling below the standard of care is, by definition, negligence. So if you have a duty toward the patient and then you perform negligently somehow, okay, we're setting up the formula for malpractice. Those are the first two elements. And negligence is defined in terms of the standard of care. We'll come back to standard of care in just a minute and talk about some documents that purport to be standard of care documents that are standards and guidelines. But for right now, we'll stick with the expert witness approach. The expert witness for each side will make a determination and render an opinion as to whether the standard of care was upheld or whether the standard of care was breached. The third part of the formula is there must be injury. Okay, there has to be some damage done. If you breach the standard of care, you don't quite uphold the standard of care, but if you don't hurt anybody, that's not malpractice. Malpractice has to include both negligence and injury. Injury means that the patient must suffer some harm. And it can be physical harm, mental harm, psychic harm. It can be harm of omission as well as commission. as chiropractors, I guess we're kind of conditioned to think of, well, gee, what could chiropractors do to hurt people? You know, we could crunch down too hard and break a rib or break a femur or something like that. And we think about those physical type injuries. And obviously, that's an injury, and that's one kind of thing to consider. But errors and negligences of omission as well as commission can be considered when we're considering injuries here. What if you failed to name a problem correctly? What if you failed to make a diagnosis? What if you considered a diagnosis but didn't follow through to find out if it was correct? What if you came up with a diagnosis and knew that that was a condition that you can't deal with, you needed to refer, but you didn't? Those would all be errors of omission, things you should have done that you didn't do. You omitted to refer, you omitted to diagnose, you didn't do the right thing. So you can have errors of commission, overt injury. We run into that in surgical cases sometimes. You know, somebody just cut off the wrong foot or take out the wrong lung or something like that. You know, that's just wrongful action. But you can neglect to do something that should have been done and also cause injury. So, and this injury must be corroborated by an outside third-party expert of some sort. The injury would necessarily be documented by another doctor, not the one being sued, but another doctor saying, yes, this person is really injured. In the case of psychic damage some sort of mental damage, then you would have a psychiatrist testifying, saying this person has been harmed, and here's how they've been harmed. In the cases of physical injury, you have another doctor saying, you know, that this person has been irreparably harmed or has been harmed in some way. So there has to be injury. So the injury has to be proven, and then we say that there must be causal connection between the negligence and the injury. The negligence must have caused the injury. Okay? So there would need to be some, the expert witness would need to testify as to the cause of the injury, and the cause of the injury must be the negligence of the person being sued. And then if we run that whole formula, that if I have a duty to the patient, they are my patient, I have a duty to perform properly, but I don't, that's negligence, okay, and my negligence causes injury, okay, and the key word in there is causes, there's a causal connection. I have the four parts of the formula, and the four parts of the formula are all there, then I could be guilty of malpractice in that case, if all four are there. Leave out one part of the formula, and there is no malpractice. Leave out the negligence, and there's no malpractice. Leave out the injury, there's no malpractice. Leave out the causal connection, there's no malpractice. So malpractice has to have every one of these. A lot of patients are attuned to, and even a lot of doctors just think about malpractice as anytime there's injury. If there's injury, you know, we automatically start thinking about suing and or being sued in the case of the doctors. And it's just not that way. You have to have more than injury. You have to have negligence. There are cases where there have been injury, but it was not due to the negligence of the doctor. It's just one of those things happen kind of cases. And if injury occurs, it does not automatically mean that the doctor was negligent. The doctor may have done the right thing. He did the reasonable, responsible, and average thing that a reasonable, responsible, and average doctor would have done, but there was still injury. So no negligence, injury, no malpractice. So, and by the other hand, on the other hand, we could have a situation where there was negligence. The doctor did something wrong. Did not uphold the standard of care, and could be documented that he didn't uphold the standard of care. But unless there was injury, there is no malpractice. Negligence alone is not malpractice. Negligence is just negligence. And if you're repeatedly negligent or negligent enough, you could maybe have charges brought against you with the state board. You might lose your license, in some way. But you're not guilty of malpractice just by negligence unless there is injury. So there are cases where people have been negligent, but no injury has occurred. That in that case, there is no malpractice. Malpractice has to have all four: duty, negligence, injury, and causal connection between the injury and the negligence. So anyway, running that formula, you have to consider each and every one of those as a sort of a separate part of the formula. They all have to be there. Those are the points of law, the points of law. And when a judge would speak to the jury just before sending the jury out to determine whether or not there's been malpractice, he's going to charge them with these points of law. And he's going to say, the judge would say, there are four parts to malpractice. Number one, number two, number three, number four. We've just mentioned them. Unless you can find each one of them unequivocally, then there is no malpractice, and I order you to come back with a non-negligent verdict in this case, unless you can pin every single one of these down. There has been no malpractice. We can talk about specific cases where there sure seems like there has been malpractice, but because of a technical breakdown of these four parts of the formula, there really isn't any malpractice. You know, there can be terrible injury sometimes, but no malpractice. There can be bad negligence, but no malpractice. So all of them have to be there.